Classical Music Festival. Wonderful piano concertos, more concerts for families to enjoy, and over 20 world premieres of brand new music, from the opening night to the last night. Tickets are on sale for the BBC Proms. Go to bbc.co.uk/proms to find out more.
BBC Radio 3, we're broadcasting between 1993 on FM, we're on digital radio and live online. It's 11 o'clock and now Jazz on 3, the best in contemporary jazz with Jez Nelson.
I never worried about chords, melodies, the keys, only sound. And the thing about it, there's only 12 notes that's satisfying the whole world. 12 notes is satisfying the whole world. I said, oh, man. And then I realized that the notes don't have a style. Either you make something out of it or you don't.
And my goodness, did he make something out of those 12 notes. Welcome along to Jazz on 3, where tonight we pay our tribute to Ornette Coleman, who died earlier this month at the age of 85. It's been really heartwarming to see the outpouring of affection for Ornette over the last few weeks, with some great tributes in the jazz world, but way beyond it too, testament to the fact that Ornette was both one of the true greats of jazz and someone whose impact was felt widely in other musics from classical to rock and more. And I don't think it's overstating it to say that much of the music that we feature on this show would sound quite different if it weren't for Ornette Coleman's eternally unique and radical approach to what he did. Well, we couldn't possibly cover his 60-plus year career comprehensively in 90 minutes, but I hope we can touch on just some of the many varied highlights. And much of tonight's music is chosen by those who knew, worked with, or were inspired by Ornette. Amongst them, Nana Cherry, Paul Blay, Branford Marsalis, and Jamaluddin Takuma. We'll also be hearing from Ornette's early soulmate, Don Cherry, and more from Ornette himself. And joining me throughout this special programme is Guardian jazz writer John Fordham, who, like many jazz fans, has had his own interesting journey with Ornette and his music. And John, we're going to get, first of all, welcome along.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Good to see you. We're going to get straight into some music, and your first choice, which is comes from, well, I think actually in a way, Ornette's last major release.
That's right, that's Sound Grammar. And that's an album that he won a Pulitzer Prize for, is a rare thing, a Pulitzer Prize for music in 2007, I think that was. And it's with his quartet, with two bass players and his son Donato on drums. But Turnaround is a tune that he wrote a very long time ago. It's one of his absolute classics and it's been covered lots of times. It's a real invitation to improvisers. So I think this is kind of, in a way, a good place to start. This is the arc of his career, this wonderful melodic sense, still being interpreted in fresh ways, and his sound is so strong, even though he's in his 70s or whatever at this point. This is a bit of a summary of the way Ornette's career and influence on music went.
Thank you.
taken from the album Sound Grammar. As John said, that won a Pulitzer Prize for music, and that was a piece called Turnaround, recorded in 2006. And John, that's a band that if people saw Ornette of the last decade and a half of his life, that's the band you would have seen him with.
Yeah, sure. I must have heard that two or three times with different bass players sometimes. But and it's also the core of the band that played at the Meltdown Festival, which Ornette curated in 2009. And the closing night of it was an absolutely spectacular occasion with the audience rushing down to the front to shake his hand and everything. And that's the group, I think, that a lot of listeners would have heard Ornette with in the last decade or so of his life, or versions of it.
In fact, I should say, although we are going to hear some recordings of Ornette and various groups playing live tonight, we don't have any music that was recorded exclusively for Jazz on 3, because Ornette would never actually let us record it, which maybe we can talk about that a little bit later on. We desperately tried to record him at that Meltdown concert. Never mind. Well, as we said, there were two bass players on that recording. We're going to hear from another bass player now, who is central to one of the other important groups in Ornette's career. That's Primetime. Now, people talk about this sort of classic quartet, and we'll hear from that later on with Don Cherry and Charlie Hayden. And this band, we've just said, was a kind of important group towards the latter period of his career. But Primetime, in a way, was another big, important statement from Ornette, and something he put a lot of time and energy into.
It certainly was, and it was another thing that utterly surprised people who were just beginning to get used to his music in the way that it had existed before. You know, Ornette's music caused a great furore amongst some people. He'd been playing acoustically for quite a long time, and then suddenly his reaction to the fact that a lot of jazz musicians were moving towards rock or taking things from rock and soul and R&B was to form Primetime, which sounded completely different to what Miles Davis had been doing for the previous few years. He had two guitar players who played polyphonically. You know, they were chattering away to each other all the way through it, with this kind of metallic, spiky noise. Donato was playing a kind of rumbling sound all the way through it that was quite different to kind of conventional rock drumming with full of backbeats and stuff. It wasn't like that. And Ornette's inimitable alto just soaring over the top of it. It just didn't sound like anybody else doing it. Didn't sound like jazz rock. Didn't sound like fusion. It was Ornette.
And central to that concept was the bass player Jamaluddin Takuma. Here he is to introduce one of his favourite moments from the band Primetime.
Primetime was really a prime time. It was the culmination of everything that he had been trying to portray and to deliver. And I think that band allowed him to do that. What we did was based on melody and composition. And people thought that we just got up there and just went blah, 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 blah. And that was not the case at all. You know, there was a very thought-out process in terms of our approach to the composition. Everybody had to know that melody, and everybody had to know how to transcend from playing that melody to coming up with your own musical ideas that did not get in the way of what anybody else was playing. I was completely turned out when he introduced this way of playing. From the bass standpoint, it completely freed me. It opened my mind in terms of just knowing that this instrument is just an instrument. One should be able to do that same thing on any instrument. This track is entitled Times Square. And what's interesting about this track is, to me, is that it brings together all of the musical colors of New York City and the energy and electricity of New York City. All of the elements that was going on in Primetime at the time, you had the quasi-disco beat along with the bass line, a definitive bass line that was funky, but yet adventurous. And if you hear that with everything else that was going on in terms of the energetic pulse of the melody and all of the things that happened from the beginning, where we played our musical ideas, it was consistent, but moving in the same direction at the same time.
masterpiece called Times Square from the album from 1979 from Ornette Coleman and Prime Time of Human Feelings, chosen by the bass player on that track, Jamal Adin Takuma. And, you know, really in a sense, straight out funk. And I say it sounds a little bit like sort of Talking Heads or something. And in Ornette's terms, quite in a sense. He's kind of playing that relatively straight.
Yeah, it's got a fantastic vitality about it. And as Jamal Adin Takuma was saying, it really makes you think about American city life. It's like being in a hotel in New York and waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning and wondering what the hell's going on around you.
You're listening to Jazz on 3. It's our tribute to Ornette Coleman, the whole of tonight's programme given over to the music of Ornette Coleman. And we have lots of tributes still to come, tracks chosen by Paul Blay and Branford Marsalis. Do let us know what your favourite Ornette Coleman recordings are. jazzon3@bbc.co.uk, or you can tweet at BBC Jazz on 3. And my guest on the programme tonight is John Fordham from The Guardian. John, we've heard a couple of moments from the latter period of Ornette's career. Let's go back to the beginnings now and talk about, I guess, the way that he got into music, because he had a very different background to many of the people we consider jazz greats, and that really shaped his musical personality for the rest of his career.
Absolutely, yeah. He did everything his own way. It was almost like he didn't know there was another way to do it. He was born in 1930, kind of grew up in Texas in the middle of the Depression. I think I remember him saying in an interview that he'd never spoken to a white person until he was 22. And his father died when he was young, and his mum gave him a saxophone as a birthday present. And he memorably said, "I thought it was a toy. I didn't know you had to find out what the toy does. I thought it was just something you played with." So that's what he did. He taught himself how to play it in completely his own way. There are bits and pieces of Charlie Parker, who he obviously admired hugely, but also a lot of R&B, a certain amount of country music, I think. He became to think that the sound of the instrument was the crucial thing, because it reflected the way people speak to each other. So when he tried sitting in with people when he was a teenager locally, they all hated it. And he was famously beaten up and the sax destroyed on one of these gigs. And he really came up the hard way with that until he could find a group of people that he was completely compatible with, and those were the people who formed his first band.
Yeah, so 1958, Ornette Coleman releases his first album. It's called Something Else, and it features a trumpet player who would become one of his most important collaborators, Don Cherry. Well, last week we spoke to Don's stepdaughter, the singer Naina Cherry, who spent a lot of time hanging out with Don, but also with Ornette when she was growing up. And here she is reflecting on those early memories and the impact of the loss of Ornette Coleman.
You know, instantly it was like the world changed colour. You know, it just becomes duller. And it's like, of course, we're making new originals, but there's something about the original originators that do so much for us and always will. It's like someone like Ornette Coleman that I think obviously is a huge influence on a lot of people, but he's been such a kind of integral part of my life, like on a daily basis, from near and from a distance, also in connection to my own family. And he was like a very strong link to them, you know, a great friend and a kind of family member, an uncle. It's like a very close thread, and like, there are none of them left now. It's very sad. Ornette's place was a place that we would always kind of exodus to. And, I've been thinking about those days a lot in the last few days, what it felt like and how he was. And, you know, one of the strongest things, of course, is that everybody was just playing music all the time. And I think most times that we would go up there and visit, he would be sitting in a chair with a note stand, either probably writing or rehearsing. He always had great clothes, things that seemed to be made out of kind of raw silk. So I think from a child's perspective, I think you notice color and textures a lot. Also thinking about sometimes like when my mother would maybe be up working and sewing and doing stuff at night, quite often she would listen to Ornette. Sometimes I would hear her singing along to his horn parts. And with Don, you know, he would always be playing, working on his own pieces, but always going back to their music and to Ornette's compositions. And my dad, as a musician, always had a lot of other musicians around him that were kind of looking to him for a kind of leadership. And I think for him, Ornette was that person. So it was kind of interesting seeing the way that Don would change in his company. And I think they were very much a unit and were probably, I mean, brothers. But he had an enormous respect for Ornette, almost like in a guru kind of type way.
Naina Cherry talking about the importance of Ornette Coleman to her father and to her. And in the same year that Don and Ornette first recorded together, 1958, they were also hired by the piano player Paul Blay to record a live album at the Hillcrest together with a couple of other characters who would become very important in the Ornette story, the bass player Charlie Hayden and the drummer Billy Higgins. Before we hear a track from that recording live at the Hillcrest, here's a message that Paul Blay recorded for us.
I knew that the next thing was coming. I had no idea who was it or where it was. So I was going everywhere looking for it. I'd go out to Pasadena. No. I'd go north to Seattle, and it was only when I started collecting tapes of the band that I realized that this was it. Stop looking, idiots. You found it. Ornette and Don could do this in rhythmic harmony. They could both do it simultaneously and make it sound like one line. Plus, they could play super fast. You got it. I never had it. Where did it go? It left somewhere after the first. And I was the band leader. I was like the star. I'm supposed to know it all. I knew nothing. Nothing. Thank you. They didn't need a piano player. They didn't hear a piano player. They didn't hear anybody playing harmony, or guitar player, or piano player. Where everybody else was choosing between a guitar and a piano, they avoided the whole problem. The best way to solve a problem is to avoid it. You can quote me on that.
Recorded at the Hillcrest Club in Los Angeles in October 1958 with Billy Higgins on drums, Charlie Hayden bass, Don Cherry trumpet, Ornette Coleman on alto and Paul Blay on piano. And I think it's an amazing sort of testament to Ornette Coleman and that group. You don't often hear musicians kind of saying, you know, I was the leader, but I couldn't keep up, and sort of writing themselves out of the story. But that's exactly what Paul Blay did there in that wonderful contribution.
Absolutely. It was magnificent, wasn't it? But, you know, he was open enough at that stage. He was the kind of new hotshot piano player everybody wanted to hear. He was young and he had kind of his career on the line in a way, but he was interested in finding out what the next thing was, as he says. You know, he started a tradition in Ornette's groups that piano players were redundant, and there wasn't another one until the 1990s.
So that group then, the quartet, minus Paul Blay, went on to record The Shape of Jazz to Come in 1959, which was this sort of seismic year for jazz, because it was also kind of Blue and Dave Brubeck, Take Five, I think, and a very important Coltrane album. So it was a big, big year, but it really was the Ornette album which stood out there. I mean, the importance of this record at the time and still now, John, incredible.
Absolutely, yeah. And the practice of the musicians playing simultaneously without chords, being able to follow each other's leads, being able to listen so well and react so fast. This was a music that was like conversing, and it, you know, as we're conversing now, we haven't figured out how many subordinate clauses we're going to have in each of our sentences, or which words we're going to use and which we aren't. So in a way, any kind of rules of conversation are only very, very general, and that's, I think, the way Ornette heard this sort of activity. But the impact of this band was huge, and of course it was huge in two directions, because Ornette got some very influential friends like Gunter Schuller, the musicologist, like Paul Blay, like Leonard Bernstein, I believe. But a lot of other people hated it, and they said he was a fraud and that he didn't know how to play.
I mean, this has been talked about a lot, but it's still extraordinary when you go back and have a look at some of the things that were said at the time. So Dizzy Gillespie said, "I don't know what he's playing, but it's not jazz." Miles Davis said, "The man is all screwed up inside." And legend has it that Max Roach took it one step further and kind of punched him in the face. People were so shocked by this music. They were really very outspoken and walking out of gigs left, right and centre.
Yeah, sure. And these people that you're quoting were the innovators of an earlier era of jazz, a very recently earlier era of jazz. So it's amazing how open you can be at one stage of life and closed at the next.
So moving forward a little bit now, and you had your own experience along these lines, John. Where the first time you saw Ornette?
Well, it was 1966, and I initially reacted in much the same way of some of those other Ornette skeptics we've been talking about, because I'd gone with my university jazz society to the Free Trade Hall in Manchester. The previous people I'd heard there had been Thelonious Monk and Norman Grant's Jazz at the Philharmonic package. I thought that's what modern jazz sounded like. A classical wind quintet came on first, so that was mystifying to start with, and then he came on with his trio with David Isenson on bass and Charles Moffett on drums, and it was really wild. And for the first half hour, I thought I was going to leave and go to the pub. there were people nodding all around me, but it wasn't me. And then the way they were conversing just got to me. I thought, wait a minute, this is like life. This is what we do.
Pivotal moment, really, in your life and career. In a sense, if you'd have left, what would have happened, John?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I'd probably become a cricket reporter on a local newspaper.
Well, look, you weren't alone, because your sort of initial scepticism was shared by someone who famously heckled that same group at their gig in Croydon a year earlier. And we're going to hear something from that concert and that famous heckle in just a moment. Before we do, though, back in 2005, Jazz on 3 tracked down the heckler. Harold Salisbury is his name. He's a saxophonist himself. And here's his side of the story.
We went with an open mind, although we'd had a couple of beers beforehand. And we were getting increasingly frustrated and disappointed in the performance. And in the course of one tune, he seemed to be just meandering away. I shouted an impromptu outburst of "Don't play Cherokee," implying that he couldn't play on chord changes.
Well, as you'll hear in a moment, Ornette did exactly that in his own way and then went on to wind up some sections of the audience even more by getting out his violin and trumpet, something that he hadn't done until that point on any of his recordings.
Well, his violin playing and his trumpet playing were even more outrageous than the saxophone playing. I mean, he scrubbed away with this violin so furiously that most of the horsehair started breaking off and waving about, and he angrily ripped some of them off and carried on scrubbing.
Scrubbing. Wonderful.
Is that your memory of that?
That's what it was like, yeah, it's true. But it scared the life out of me when I heard it first, but listening back on it now, it makes me think the American critic Gary Giddens wrote a piece about Ornette, for which the title was Harmelodic Hoedown. It's got a kind of crazed barn dance quality about it in some ways. Actually, some of his trumpet playing reminds me a bit of some of the more out trumpet playing that Miles did in his most kind of abstract fusion periods. And Miles would never have admitted, I think, that he listened to any of Ornette, but you just wonder whether any of that filtered through.
You're listening to Jazz on 3. We are paying tribute to Ornette Coleman, who died a couple of weeks ago. Still to come, contributions from Branford Marsalis and Don Cherry. But now we're going to hear a 20-minute extract from that 1965 concert recorded in Croydon. Two pieces, starting with Silence, complete with Heckel, followed by Falling Stars, where Ornette gets the violin out. David Isenson is on bass and Charles Moffat is on drums.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ornette Coleman recorded in Croydon, of all places, in 1965 with David Isenson on bass and Charles Moffat on drums. First of all, we heard Silence and then we heard Falling Stars. You're listening to Jazz on 3 with me, Jazz Nelson, a tribute to Ornette Coleman. My guest throughout the programme tonight is John Fordham from The Guardian. John, we've obviously spoken about the fact that he was sort of seen as this radical by some and was outside of the establishment doing things his own way. But that isn't to say that he wasn't, in his own way, a student of and respectful of the jazz tradition.
I think he was a really focused and meticulous student of everything he took on. He was a kind of beachcomber of it all and picked it all up in his own way. But Charlie Parker was central to his sound, and you hear it very clearly in the earlier records, but I think all the way through you can. I think there's fragments of bop phrasing the way Parker would have done it, and of course Parker's enormously emotional involvement in the blues, which is always there right through it. And in 2009, when we were all celebrating the anniversary of those great 1959 albums you mentioned, we got Nathaniel Facey into the studio here of Empirical to demonstrate some of Ornette's thinking and some of the influences on his thinking, and particularly Charlie Parker.
He's like the only one for me that kind of really captures the essence of Bird and manages to sort of develop it and translate it into his own language, particularly on the album Something Else. There's a tune on there called When Will the Blues Leave, which goes... I'll try and do something that is in the style of Charlie Parker. Emphasis on the word try. Parts from that whole thing of everything being built off of chords. Ornette's thing really was about the line really becoming king as opposed to the chord changes. So his line could take any kind of harmonic direction. I'll try and demonstrate.
Saxophonist Nathaniel Facey talking about Ornette's unique voice back in 2009. Well, earlier on we were talking about the importance of The Shape of Jazz to Come, that first record with what would become a legendary quartet recorded in 1959. Well, here's another member of sax royalty from a younger generation, Branford Marsalis, to introduce us to his favourite moment from that album.
As far as saxophone playing goes, Ornette Coleman was not a good saxophone player at all. But the gravitas of the ideas completely outweigh any limitations that he might have had on the saxophone. I venture so far to say that the music wouldn't even have the same density that it did if he were a better saxophone player, because oftentimes guys who have great technique rely on technique more than they rely on ideas. So in a lot of ways, the lack of proficiency on the instrument propelled him to create a sound that is quite fantastic and quite unique. I think he's probably the first musician I've ever heard playing Western music in an improvisatory way, where he was free of the limitations of the 4-bar, 8-bar, 12-bar, 24-bar construct. And Chronology, for instance, has a 9-bar A section. I think it's 9. But it's essentially rhythm changes. And the song Peace has a song form. So when you hear a person playing like this in song form, it changed the way that I thought about music and about what could be possible. ¶¶
103rd Street is Watts, where I was raised. Across from the police station, there was a record shop. And they had all the sides. You know, that was like the educational center. All the 78 records were there. You could buy reeds, oil. And that's where I met Ornette one day. And he had on a coat. And he was the first person I had seen with long hair. And the overcoat he had, it was very hot. And he was trying a very thick reed, you know, I think like a 4.5. Now he may play he probably plays a 1. And could hear it a block away because it sounded like a horse that was, you know, a horse whinny. But his sound was like that you could hear it all the way to Central Avenue. But quite a story, because hearing Ornette was something. You know, you have the feeling of, and this happens in art a lot, of a painting or even a poetry or a piece of music. You hear it for the first time and you know you never heard it before, but it's something about it that feels familiar. And that's the way I felt when I first heard Ornette.
Trumpet player Don Cherry talking to me back in 1990. And before that, Branford Marsalis with his feelings about Ornette, and particularly that piece, cool piece, from the album The Shape of Jazz to Come from 1959. John, you were talking earlier about Ornette's slightly unusual route into the music, the fact that he was given this toy saxophone and he just sort of played it. He didn't realise there were any rules, in a sense. And very early on, he developed this voice, which throughout his career was so strong, kind of almost the closest to the human voice you ever hear coming through a saxophone.
Absolutely. That cry at the top end, which is absolutely goes right back into the earliest roots of the blues, the kind of falsetto sound of blues singers. And his phrasing too. He's got a beautiful thing where over a fast piece he'll build up something in quite sort of compact phrases, and then he'll kind of skip all the way down. It sort of makes you think of a child skipping or somebody laughing, a sort of cackling descent.
If you want to hear more from The Shape of Jazz to Come, amongst other great Ornette Coleman recordings, then do have a listen to Jeffrey Smith on Ornette Coleman, a programme that he recorded earlier in the year but has been repeated as a tribute to Ornette, and that's available on the Radio 3 website now.
You know, in a way, what they were doing was very political. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's why I fell in love with punk and hip-hop. I think that they were like the big daddies, you know, very colourful, you know, kind of intellectual but also militant, that fearlessness and that playfulness, you know. And I think that the a bit of revolution, you know, we need to make some noise, you know, and not be so careful and so complacent and passive. You know, we need to make some changes, and Ornette certainly did, and I give thanks for that.
Stepdaughter of Don Cherry, Ornette Coleman's longtime partner, that was Naina Cherry. John, I said at the beginning of the programme that there have been tributes paid not just in the jazz community but in the wider world, actually. It's been really nice to see that, actually. Sort of the broadsheets have all covered it, and there's been people from all different kinds of music who have been recognising his importance. He famously played quite a lot with the Grateful Dead. I think people like Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth have quoted him as a great influence. And we saw some of that, of course, in his curation of the Meltdown Festival back in 2009.
Yeah, I remember reading something by Steve Reich once where he was talking about hearing Coltrane and Ornette Coleman and all those people in the late 50s and early 60s, where he was at music college watching a lot of people studying incredibly complicated theories of how modern composing should be done. And then you go into a club at night and somebody walks on with a saxophone and does this extraordinary stuff and then walks off again. And the great Alex Ross, the writer for The New Yorker, who's primarily a classical person, although he's very open-minded, he thought that Ornette's views on composition more or less defined what composition should be. Ornette said something simple like, composing for me is a way of not repeating. And Alex Ross said, well, there's no better definition of composing than that.
We're going to hear a couple of examples now of Ornette reaching out into different areas, very different examples. In a moment, we'll hear him playing with the master musicians of Djeduka, who he sort of came across in the homeland of Morocco, I think hanging out perhaps with William Burroughs in the mountains of northern Morocco. But first of all, something from Skies of America, which was a major orchestral work recorded with the London Symphony Orchestra in London in 1972. This is The Good Life.
Thank you.
Ornette Coleman with the Master Musicians of Jujuka and Midnight Sunrise from the album Dancing in Your Head from 1977. Before we heard that piece from Dancing in Your Head, we heard a piece from Skies of America with the London Symphony Orchestra from 1972. And the sleeve notes to this, Ornette talks, as he did often throughout his career, about the harmonic theory. And here he says this work is based on a theory called harmonic theory, which uses only melody, harmony and the instrumentation of movement of forms. He says, I've often read critical pieces where the critic said that what the composer was trying to do didn't come off. I've wondered what the critic meant if he didn't know what the composer was trying to do. Harmonics, John, because you were saying earlier on how Ornette had made this simple statement about classical composition. He was also capable of, to some extent, baffling with his theories on occasion. Depending on what period you read him talking about harmonics, it can be quite confusing. The theory seems to shift around. Give us your take.
Well, I can only assume, you just have to listen closely to the way Ornette's bands play, where it's in a way that they have to forget what they know rather than learn something new. I think that's words like innocent or childlike are sometimes referred very positively to Ornette, and I think that's what it is. Somebody plays a line and you concentrate on the line. It's like a group of people very compatibly talking together, not trying to override each other or get in each other's way or win something, but to make something organic develop by really close attention. It's now quite natural in jazz, and almost every good jazz musician in contemporary music can play like that without needing to know what harmonics means.
As I mentioned earlier on, Ornette had an influence way beyond jazz in his music. While we were listening to that piece, John, you were mentioning Lou Reed, who was another fan of his music. And he also had an influence on the punk scene. And we've been hearing throughout this programme from Nana Cherry, stepdaughter of Don Cherry. Nana very much at the heart of the kind of origins, I guess, of the sort of post-punk movement with her group Rip, Rig and Panic. And here she is to introduce one of her favourite Ornette Coleman pieces.
I've chosen a track off Science Fiction, and it's called All My Life. Asha Pudli sings All My Life, and she also sings What Reason, which I recorded with The Thing. And I kind of got into listening to them, and when I was maybe 14 or 15, I remember making like a mixtape, and I put All My Life like next to Johnny Guitar Watson or something like that. All My Life was actually the song that I personally wanted to cover, but What Reason was the one that suited my voice a little bit better. So that's why I want to play All My Life. And I it's like a family member. I love it. Beautiful. Bye.
demonstrating just what a range of music he made throughout his career. 1971, All My Life from Science Fiction with Asha Putley on vocals. Ornette Coleman on alto saxophone, that piece chosen for us by Naina Cherry. Of course, we couldn't possibly get even close to covering the breadth and depth of the music that Ornette Coleman recorded throughout his career in just 90 minutes. So we'd love to hear what you think we should be adding to our playlist. Email me, jazzon3@bbc.co.uk, or you can tweet at @bbcjazzon3. Some of you have been coming up with suggestions on Twitter already. Cosmic Jazz said that one of their favourites is Faces and Places from the Live at the Golden Circle sessions on Blue Note Records. Ollie Bryce said the great Live in Paris 1971 set. And Chris Barrett says, I just keep coming back to Song X, the recording he made with Pat Metheny. And as I mentioned earlier on, there have been some fantastic tributes paid in the newspapers and online to Ornette Coleman. Some really wonderful reflections on his life. And Robert Wyatt says, his voice is immediately unique, as if he were the last surviving speaker of an ancient language. One of the greats of Ornette's generation, Wayne Shorter, said Ornette was one of my favourite astronauts, a musical astronaut. Anyone who has that astronaut thing knows what it takes and knows what it is, and they're ready to go down with the ship. Fantastic. John, we're going to finish the programme with a final choice from you. Before we do that, coming after Wayne Shorter with that fantastic line, they're ready to go.
It's
very hard to top that, but a kind of final thought from you about Ornette Coleman.
I just think he's outside of music, he's a tremendous inspiration to people's self-respect. It's about, I mean, these are all kind of buzzwords in a way, but it's about empowerment, it's about courage, it's about listening and empathy and tolerance, you know, all qualities that the world needs an awful lot more of. He showed how you could take in what was going on around you, take in a tradition you were part of, listen to all your fellow human beings and make something of it that's a unique art and which is an inspiring art for everybody, whatever they're doing and whatever they're coming from, whatever their interests are. And when will there be his like again? Well, there won't be his like again, but somebody else who has the same bravery and vision.
Thank you very much for being my guest tonight, John.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you also to my producer, Chris Elcombe, who worked so hard to pull this programme together over the last week or so. Just time to say that next week on Jazz on 3, we're joining Classical Voice season on the BBC over a fortnight of programmes celebrating vocal music across Radio 3, BBC 2 and BBC 4. And we're giving it, of course, a jazz twist. My co-presenter for that programme will be Dee Dee Bridgewater, joining me to select some choice cuts from the Jazz on 3 archives. Expect performances from vocalists including Cassandra Wilson, Bobby McFerrin, Kurt Elling, and the singer we've heard from a couple of times this evening, that's Naina Cherry. Thank you to Naina and all of the people who've appeared on this programme tonight. Good night, and we'll leave you with Ornette Coleman playing with the piano player Joachim Kuhn, recorded live in 1996 from an album called Colours. This is a piece called House of Stained Glass. But just before that, we'll leave the last word to Ornette himself. Good night.
I'm not trying to prove anything to anybody. I want to be as human as I can get, believe me. And there's nothing I'm trying to hide. There's nothing I'm trying to climb above. There's nothing I'm trying to destroy. No one is going to suffer from what the human race does because it's not going to destroy itself. It's going to improve itself. Music is something that, to me, is nothing but the sound of your emotions. It's your heart, it's your feelings, it's your belief, it's your ability, and most of all, it's your love. And what's so beautiful about it, it's not destructive. It's always something that gets better.